Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Massachusetts has set some ambitious goals when it comes to reducing the state's output of greenhouse gases, cutting that output by 25% by the year 2020. And to reach that benchmark, the Baker administration wants to add more clean energy capacity into the mix, including hydropower from Canada. Well, just yesterday, adding that extra hydropower capacity to the New England grid just got one step closer to reality. The U.S. Department of Energy has granted a permit to the Northern Pass, a nearly 200-mile-long proposed power line that would slice through much of New Hampshire. Now, Granite State officials still need to approve the project, but here's Eversource spokesman Martin Murray on the Energy Department's decision.
We are incredibly well poised to deliver what Massachusetts is requiring and what its citizens want, and that's clean hydroelectric energy from Canada that economically will benefit all of New England.
Well, it may be clean, but it's not morally pure, to be honest, because the hydro energy that would flow through the Northern Pass is fraught with a deep history in northern Canada, and it has impacts beyond the environment and our energy needs in New England. It has displaced the Indigenous peoples of Quebec Province, to name the least. Now, the podcast Outside In from our friends at New Hampshire Public Radio has dug into the environmental and true human costs of hydropower from Canada. It's the topic of a four-part series titled Powerline, and the second episode is out now. Sam Evans Brown is the host of Outside In. He joins us now from Concord, New Hampshire. Sam, welcome to Radio Boston.
So happy to be on the show.
So first of all, I want to talk to you about Northern Pass, actually, because I know it's been hugely controversial in New Hampshire. What's the reaction there to the decision to approve the Northern Pass by the Department of Energy?
Well, I'd say that this particular decision is, you know, it's a major milestone for the project, but it's one that really was not unexpected. I think even the opponents, you know, would occasionally suggest that maybe the presidential permit wouldn't be granted, but it was always kind of a half-hearted suggestion. It was always assumed that the real action on this decision would be at the state level, which is, of course, now pending. We're looking at a deadline of February 28th for a final decision at long last for a project that was first announced back in 2011.
Wow. Okay. So, you know, it's interesting that you should mention that because I was telling my producer, Jamie, today that I remember a couple presidential cycles ago, I was in northern New Hampshire in the White Mountains when Newt Gingrich was running, and he was at a event at some diner in the Whites, and people were asking him, why doesn't he think, or should the Northern Pass, should those power lines be put underground? I mean, I think to this day, you drive up there and you see lots and lots of the Northern Pass bumper stickers, right? I mean, people do not like this project up there.
Well, and it's sort of by dint of any project taking this long, it means that a very vigorous and organized opposition has been able to form and coalesce around the project, and they are incredibly organized. But I will say, you know, the polling data that we have, which is a little sparse, does show that the state is pretty closely divided among the folks who've heard about it. It's pretty 50-50.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Maybe it's just I've been talking to a lot of folks who would have had those power lines go right through their yards.
Yeah. And I'd say it's one of these instances where the opposition is so much more activated than the people who are in favor. I mean, you have some unions who would benefit from the project, and they are sort of getting out, and they've got their own signs. But in terms of the fervor on the two sides, it is quite unbalanced. The opposition is much more engaged than the people who are in favor.
I see. Okay. So let's move further north then, as your series Power Line does, because we are talking about the power that's coming from Hydro-Québec. Now, you visited a dam complex that was some 16-hour drive north of Montreal. Do I have that right?
That's right.
I keep forgetting how big Canada is.
There's a lot north of those cities.
Okay. And so you saw some of the turbines there at the hydropower complex, 22 of them in one facility. And let's play a clip here of you and your tour guide at the facility. The tour guide's a person named Eric Hamill.
So if one of these can power a city, then how much does the whole facility, you said it's...
Oh, this is the equivalent of of a town of close to 1.6 million people.
I think that's a city. That's a city, right?
That's one. Yes, it's a little bigger than our town. You know, in the Red Sun, we're 280 people, so no problem. We have quite enough with this machine.
Quite enough, yes. So, Sam, I mean, just give us a quick sense here. How large is Hydro-Québec? How much power does it produce?
So Hydro-Québec has 62 powerhouses. We're talking, you know, several dozen rivers. And the James Bay complex, the one that I was visiting there in that clip, it's a drainage area roughly the size of France. So it's simply enormous. And it provides not just, I mean, it's 98-99% of the electricity in the province, but that really underestimates how important it is to the energy mix up there because this electricity is so cheap. Something like 70% of Quebecers actually heat their homes with electricity. So it's not just the lights and your smartphones. It's also a huge portion of the heat load, which here in New England is, you know, a lot of folks are burning oil or propane or natural gas.
Wow. And I understand that Hydro-Québec produces a $2 billion dividend that goes straight into Quebec's coffers every year.
Yeah, in fact, it's a crown corporation. It's the only shareholder of this corporation is the Quebecois government, and so that means that not only does it generate $2 billion or so worth of tax revenue, but there's this additional $2 billion dividend that, if this were a private company, would be going to private shareholders, but instead goes to the government.
Okay, so great for modern day Quebecois. And perhaps, you know, good for New England if Hydro-Québec's power comes down here. But the project goes back to what, the 1950s?
So the first dams have dams that are actually more than 100 years old.
Oh, I see. Okay.
That are still kicking. But what Hydro-Québec was born, so the modern iteration of the company was born in the 1960s. And that's really when the dam building boom took off. That's when they started building these mega projects. There's the Manic-Outard mega project and then the James Bay mega project. And you know, you can look at this sort of graph of their capacity, which just skyrockets in those years.
And that was the time which they came into significant conflict with the native peoples there, right?
Yes, indeed. And their first mega projects, they were able to sort of get them in without notifying any native people and without getting any major pushback. And that was the first place that we visited, a place called Pessimitz, which hosts something like a third of Hydro-Québec's hydro capacity. And a lot of these people, you know, they were living this sort of quasi-nomadic lifestyle, and they were paddling upriver one year, and all of a sudden they came around the river bend to find that there was a dam being built on this river that their families had been using for millennia, really. But then the next project, the James Bay project, ran up against the Crees, and the Crees learned that this thing had been announced. There was a lot of fanfare around the James Bay project, and they immediately decided to lawyer up. They filed an injunction. They got work stopped and really kind of changed Canadian history, because this process of having to sit down at the table with First Nations and developers at the same table, it became a model for how Canada would negotiate what are now called modern treaties.
Mm. Well, we have more tape here from the podcast to that point. This is Robert Konodowat, chief of the Chisabi Cree, and he spoke to you about some of those negotiations between Hydro-Québec and his people back in the 70s.
What they say, you know, is that we weren't the owners of the land. You know, they kept saying that. And we said that we managed to convince that they are trespassing, you know, that they should pay for taking our land, our resources, our livelihood, and the way we want to live.
Sam, the part of that cut that really stays with me is that the Cree had to convince the Canadian government that they were the owners of the land.
Yes, indeed. And it gets to this really fascinating history of treaty making in Canada, which is that sort of as settlement moved west and as the British conquered the French, this policy of signing treaties so that you had kind of a paper trail to say that, hey, we own the land, was instituted. But that didn't begin until they got to Ottawa and Manitoba. And so the provinces, the eastern provinces, there were never any treaties signed in which the First Nations formally relinquished their land rights, which meant that this was kind of and in many places, it's still an open question as to exactly who owns this land.
Still an open question. Wow. I mean, but as the decades went on, though, had the way that the authorities around Hydro-Québec and their interactions with the First Nations there improved? Have those relations changed significantly?
They have. In fact, and this came from, so the Crees won, they were signed the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement, which was this landmark first deal, but many of the tenants weren't really being honored, they felt, and so they kicked up another fight in the 80s and 90s against another hydro project called the Great Whale, which many people here in New England in the Northeast might have heard of this fight. This is when the Crees built a boat with the Inuit, and they paddled down to New York City, and they enlisted, Robert Kennedy Jr. into their fight, and they managed to stop that project dead in its tracks, which meant that after this, Hydro-Québec learned that they would have to pivot. And now, whenever they propose a project, they immediately start by reaching out to communities affected, and they have to consult and accommodate is the legal language. They have to talk with the communities who are affected and try to accommodate their concerns before they can build a project.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've just got a couple seconds left here, Sam. I'm curious now, bring us to the present day, how much is the fact that Massachusetts wants more hydropower from Hydro-Québec? Are we a small player here or a big one? Could have any effect on what's happening in Canada?
Well, it's actually really fascinating. Over the years that I've been covering energy here in New Hampshire, I've increasingly realized that Massachusetts is the player. Massachusetts is 50% of the load in New England, and Massachusetts energy policy really, in many ways, becomes de facto New England energy policy. So yes, whether this power line gets built or not basically will be up to the Bay State.
Wow. Well, Sam Evans-Brown is the host of the NHPR podcast Outside In, and together with producer Hannah McCarthy, they've got this four-part series, terrific one, called Powerline. The first two episodes are now available. We've got links to them at radioboston.org. Sam, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, that's it for today and this week. Thanks so much for spending this time with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.